From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Ted Clark. This week, a former military dictator in Guatemala goes on trial, accused of genocide. In Iraq, two sisters with two very different destinies following the war. And a musician from the West African nation of Mali explores the violence of religious extremists in a new album. This past week in Guatemala, prosecutors presented their case against a former military dictator. General Efrain Reyes-Montt ruled during one of the bloodiest periods in the country's long civil war. He's accused of genocide in the murder of tens of thousands of Guatemalans. As NPR's Carrie Kahn reports, victims and human rights advocates have struggled for years to bring Reyes-Montt to trial.
Antonio Cava, an Ishil Indian with jet black hair, high cheekbones, and a soft smile, remembers the exact date in 1982 when his peaceful childhood high in the Guatemalan mountains came to an end. He was 11.
Fue el 15 de enero.
It was the 15th of January. The soldiers came into town at 10:30 at night and started kicking down doors. My father woke me up. He said, "Son, we have to leave." I grabbed my brothers, and we ran into the forest and climbed into the trees. It was a full moon. We could see the soldiers. We could hear our neighbors being tortured and screaming for help. There was nothing we could do.
2 months later, the soldiers returned. This time they rounded up the entire village. The women were sent into the village's schoolhouse, the men into the church next door. Cava says he then heard the order come over a soldier's radio, "Shoot them all."
Y uno por uno lo mataba, lo mataba, lo mataba.
One by one, they killed the men. They killed them. In an instant, 95 people. They killed 95 people.
Cava's story is not an isolated one. In 1999, a UN Truth Commission concluded that thousands of Ishil Indians were killed at the hands of the military. Some of the worst atrocities occurred during the 17-month rule of Reyes-Montt from 1982 to 83. The commission ruled the killings genocide, but no one was ever brought to trial. That's until a group of human rights lawyers, including a young attorney, now Guatemala's leading prosecutor, Claudia Paz y Paz, began the decades-long fight to prosecute Reyes-Montt in international courts and at home.
Significa un mensaje muy fuerte que nadie está por encima de la ley.
Paz says this trial sends a strong message that no one here is above the law. Such a statement is unprecedented in Guatemala, where impunity has long reigned and the country's powerful are used to manipulating the state's weak judicial system. Danilo Rodriguez, a member of Reyes-Montt's defense team, says the former general is being railroaded. He says the prosecution is out to settle political scores and is opening old wounds.
El delito de genocidio debe de probarse la intención.
Rodriguez says to prove genocide, the prosecution must show there was intent to destroy an ethnic group. He says there clearly were atrocities, but they were committed by rogue field commanders and not by Reyes-Montt. Prosecutors say they have forensic evidence, declassified U.S. government files, and even the former general's own words to prove their case. In 1982, he bragged to a young American filmmaker about his total control of the military.
Porque si yo no puedo controlar el ejército. Entonces, ¿qué estoy haciendo aquí?
On camera, mustachioed, dark-haired Reyes-Montt smiles and says, "If I can't control the army, then what am I doing here?" Reyes-Montt is now 86, with a full head of gray hair, and has been under house arrest since January. With dozens of survivors scheduled to testify, the trial is expected to last well into summer. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Guatemala City.
The U.S. has the highest rate of gun ownership per capita in the world. It's estimated that Americans own nearly 300 million firearms. Also high on the list, Switzerland. It's fourth in terms of gun ownership, and that's where we go for our next story. Historically, Switzerland has had a remarkably low rate of gun violence, but NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson reports that a number of gun attacks in recent years have the Swiss rethinking their relatively liberal gun laws.
A handful of youngsters with air guns practice hitting paper targets at the shooting range outside Zurich. Their instructor, Erich Knobel, monitors the students' progress. They will move up to regular guns as they become more proficient. Knobel tells them, "Keep your guns up so I can check your form." Among his students is 11-year-old Greta Wolf, the shy sixth grader who is from Germany, where firearms are far more restricted, is the only girl here on this day. She also is one of the best shots.
Schießen war jetzt einfach als Klavier lernen.
Shooting a gun was easier to learn than playing the piano, says Greta, who is also an accomplished swimmer. She says key to her success at shooting is patience, practice, and deep breaths. Her father, Markus Wolf, also shoots.
Der hat auf dem Schützenfest in so einer Schießbude mit dem Luftgewehr geschossen und hat mich dann gefragt, ob wir das mal.
He says his daughter began target shooting more than 18 months ago after seeing her older brother Vincent do it. Wolf adds that the sport has improved his children's concentration. Nearby, René Collos smiles. He's a Swiss Army veteran and collector who owns hundreds of guns and heads youth training at the Zurich Shooting Sports Association.
Heute haben wir in unserer Gesellschaft ein Überangebot von verschiedensten Möglichkeiten, sich zu betätigen.
Curlo says there are so many activities available to young people these days that it's difficult to get them interested in shooting. But he and others acknowledge that even among Swiss adults, interest in firearm ownership is waning. Part of it is due to the shrinking size of the conscripted militia that serves as the National Army. As a result, fewer Swiss men between the ages of 20 and 30 are storing weapons at home. There's also pressure on Switzerland to adhere to the Schengen Agreement. It opens borders between most European countries, but also makes buying and owning guns more difficult than the Swiss are used to. Stephen Halbrook, a Virginia-based author and lawyer who has argued cases for the NRA, has been a frequent visitor to the Alpine country since 1991.
The European countries themselves, there's a mandate to register all guns and to have a central electronic registration. Germany just announced that it was the first to do so, to implement that. That was on January 1 of this year. And the other ones are supposed to follow suit.
A growing anti-gun movement in Switzerland, strengthened by local shooting attacks and Swiss research on violence, is also pushing for improved gun control. While firearm deaths are much lower here than in the United States, one Swiss death for every seven U.S. deaths, guns are often used in suicides and crimes of passion. Suzanne Peter heads the Zurich Women's Shelters Association.
Also, wir haben immer wieder Frauen, wir nennen sie Klientinnen.
She says a fifth of her clients report having been threatened with guns by their male spouses or partners who keep military-issued weapons at home.
Also etwa ein Fünftel der Klientinnen berichten davon.
Swiss society must take responsibility and deal with it, Peta adds. A recent study by the Institute of Social and Preventive Medicine at the University of Bern raises similar concerns about gun violence. Epidemiology professor Marcel Zwalen was among the researchers who conducted a review of 158 Swiss murders and suicides where the attacker and victim lived in the same households. He says 9 of every 10 cases involved firearms. He says owning a gun in Switzerland is easier than owning dogs or cars, but shouldn't be.
It's okay to regulate how you are allowed to have it, how you should use it, and that this gets checked.
Lawyer Hans-Peter Uster agrees. He's a former justice minister from the Swiss canton or state of Zug, who was shot in the chest by a gunman who stormed the regional assembly there in September 2001. The assailant killed 14 people before turning the gun on himself.
Es ist sicher jetzt wichtig, dass diese Registrierung aller Waffen.
Uster says he hasn't touched a gun since the attack. He adds he's always had concerns about the wide availability of firearms in Switzerland. Estimates range from 2.5 million guns to more than 3 million, and most are military-issued rifles. Many historians credit the armed-to-the-teeth tradition with protecting Switzerland from the Nazis in World War II. But Uster and others say it's time for the Swiss government to act to prevent shooting attacks like the one in Zug.
Ich war schon vor dem Attentat sehr skeptisch gegen die vielen Schusswaffen, die es in der Schweiz gibt.
It's certainly important that all these weapons are secured, legally speaking. Having them registered in each Swiss state and having those states share the data is also important. We need laws passed to make this happen, as well as a committed government.
The local equivalent of the NRA rejects any new restrictions. It argues there are plenty already, including a crackdown in the past 18 months on the purchase and transport of ammunition. Hermann Sutter is vice president of the Swiss group ProTel, named after William Tell, who used a crossbow to target his enemies.
You can't register the weapons which are in hands of criminals. So it doesn't help you to prevent a tragedy, you know?
He, like many Swiss, blame local gun violence on criminals from other countries, as well as the mentally ill who aren't supposed to own guns. So far, the majority of Swiss voters have agreed that gun control is not the way forward. 2 years ago, 57% of them voted against storing military-issued guns in armories rather than at home. They saw it as undermining trust in Swiss soldiers, Sutter says.
Every militia soldier has the right and even the duty to take his personal arm, as long as he is in active service, back home. Of course, as soon as the soldier leaves his service, he has to change the mechanism so that he cannot shoot automatically, you know, but only one shot after the other.
Sind die Schützen bereit?
The single-shot action is evident at this recent shooting contest in the town of Pfäffikon. The top shooters win a wheel of local cheese or coupon worth $10. Many of them use converted military weapons to shoot the paper targets, which are some 300 yards away. Guns not in use sit out in the open.
It's a Heiligtum, das macht niemand. Am eigenen Schützenfest.
Those guns are safe because it violates Swiss tradition to touch another person's weapon without his or her permission, says Urs Steli, president of the Zurich Shooting Sports Association. What is expected, however, is for participants to gather in the local pub and discuss the day's shoot over a steaming drink spiked with plum brandy. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News.
Coming up, Islamist extremists try to ban music in a country renowned for song, smuggling timber in Afghanistan, and in Iraq, women are left with fewer options after the war. During Afghanistan's long, freezing winters, most people heat their homes with wood-burning stoves. Officials say that's a partial explanation for the ongoing deforestation in the country. But as NPR's Sean Carberry reports, the bigger problem is the illegal harvesting and smuggling of timber.
This is a bukhari. It looks like an old oil drum with a big rusty pipe growing out of the top that bends off into a hole in the wall. Despite Afghanistan's fierce winter, it's rare to find a house with insulation or a modern heating system. That fact keeps the hundreds of wood vendors around Kabul quite happy. This winter, we fed several tons of firewood to our bukharis, and that's just one house in a city of around 5 million.
Three, 4 decades ago, 50% of the total land was covered by forest.
Wali Modakik is the deputy director of Afghanistan's Environmental Protection Agency. He says that today forests cover only about 2% of Afghanistan. He says years of war and drought have felled more trees than wood stoves, which generally burns scrap wood. The big killer of trees, though, is economics.
There is a huge demand for Afghan timber in the international market.
Commercial timber harvesting is illegal here. That means the international demand is being satisfied by a massive smuggling industry. The remaining forest is in places like Kunar province, bordering Pakistan, which is the main outlet for Afghan timber now.
There is no business here but the timber business.
Haji Hamadullah is a businessman in Kunar province.
It's called Kunar, which means the homeland of mountains. Once upon a time, when there was anarchy here, people started cutting down the forest to make money.
That was during the war with the Soviets and the subsequent civil war. Now there is law, but law in Afghanistan often doesn't translate from paper to practice, and that applies to the timber business.
There's a big business running during the night. All the top officials, including the governor, police chief, and head of the provincial council, are involved and are paid their share.
And Hamidullah knows because he used to be in the business.
When I was caught, all my timber was put on sale by the government, despite the fact I had paid a lot of money in bribes to many officials.
Ashikullah is from Asadabad, the capital of Kunar. He's head of the Youth Provincial Council, but even he acknowledges that he smuggles on the side. He says there's a clear system.
A specific amount of tax is levied on each truckload of timber. The deal is made during the day between the officials and the smugglers. The cutting and transportation go on at night.
Smuggling is not possible now.
Not surprisingly, Fazlullah Wahidi, the governor of Kunar, says this is all bunk.
This is very old stories because this was happened in wartime. But now we have strong military, we have strong border police, and we have strong national police.
But according to smugglers and residents of Kunar, those policemen are on the take. The governor was about the only person in Kunar who denied the timber as being illegally harvested and smuggled. Wally Modakic with the Environmental Protection Agency points out a catch-22 that makes it difficult to stop the smuggling.
Official policy is that to involve the local communities to manage the natural resources, especially the forest.
But the local people of Kunar have few ways to earn money other than working for smugglers.
They're providing job opportunities for those people.
So the very people empowered to protect the forests have a strong economic incentive to cut them down. And with law enforcement officials complicit in the business, the remaining 2% of the forest in the country may not be standing for long. Sean Carberry, NPR News, Kabul.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Ted Clark. It's been 10 years since the U.S. invaded Iraq. In 2007, we brought you the story of two sisters who had lost their parents. The older sister wore conservative clothes and recited poetry. The younger sister, just 13 at the time, appeared to be on the verge of becoming a prostitute. NPR's Kelly McEvers and Isra Al-Rubaii went looking for the two sisters again. They sent this report.
Like so many stories in Iraq, especially sensitive ones involving shame and sex, the story has to be peeled away in layers, like an onion. It starts with the older sister, Shahed. We recently found Shahed in a dingy two-room house in East Baghdad. Shahed's crippled grandmother lies on her stomach on the floor, smoking and sometimes moaning in pain. Shahed says as bad as the situation is now, it's better than it was before.
Before, we only had that room. Then there was this charity league who built us this other room.
Shahed says her mother abandoned the family years ago. The father went to prison for killing a man about a year after the U.S. invaded Iraq. Shahed says her sister, the one who is about to become a prostitute, whose name is Ragad, has now been set on the right path. The family arranged for her to get married. She's now 18, Shahed says, and she has two children.
I know she was different, she was overactive, and she still is. But now she focuses more on her life, on her children, and on how to take care of her husband.
The longer we stay, though, and the more questions we ask, we realize Ragad hasn't totally changed. Shahed closes the door and lowers her voice. Ragad still wears too much makeup, she says. Her jeans are still too tight. When she comes to visit, she likes to stand at the window and wave at men.
Yeah, she might talk to strangers and go out with them. Maybe she would let him touch her hand, kiss her.
This all might sound benign to us, but in Iraq, it's downright dangerous. Especially in a poor, conservative neighborhood where not only will the neighbors and relatives shun the girls, but Shiite militias sometimes impose religious law with violence. In other words, this could get you killed. Shahed says even after Ragad got married, She still wanted something more.
She was dreaming of falling in love with someone and, you know, living all this passion and feelings, like a romance, like what she saw on TV.
At first, Shahad says her sister just needs to grow up. But eventually, she admits she doesn't even want her to come to the house anymore. It starts to become clear Shahad isn't telling us everything. All she'll say is perhaps it's the fact that they're poor that made Raghad this way.
Maybe our situation did affect Raghad in a way, that she lacks attention and she was looking for, as an escape from this bitter reality, she would seek attention from outside the house.
We try to contact Raghad for days. Everyone gives us a different story. Her husband won't let her out. She's busy with the kids. We decide to try to find her on our own. We go with Raghad's brother to the house where she lives with her husband's family.
They say she's not there. They want to tell you her story. Apparently she has some story.
The family tells us Raghad has run away. Her brother, Noor, says she took her two-year-old with her, left the baby behind, and went north.
I called her yesterday and I talked to her and said, come back, but she said no.
It's clear the brother wants to say more. In a low voice, he admits Raghad has run off to be with their mother.
I'll tell you the story that no one knows. My mother was a prostitute.
A prostitute who lives in the north. Raghad has gone to join her, he says, to work with her. At this point, Noor says he's out of options to get Raghad back home. We drop Noor off back at his job running the neighborhood generator. The skinny 21-year-old looks like he has the weight of the world on his shoulders. Aid organizations that work with women in Iraq say the story of what happened to Raghad is all too common. In a society where religion has filled the gaps for social practices that were shattered by war, women simply have fewer options. They're expected to get married very young. Education is less and less of a priority. For girls like Raghad, aid workers say choosing prostitution might be the only way they think they can be free. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
When Islamist rebels took over parts of northern Mali, they imposed strict laws banning singing and dancing in a culture where music is central. Musicians fled south to the capital, Bamako, or out of the country. Since then, a French-led offensive has pushed back the rebels and eased the restrictions. Now, one of Mali's best-known musicians from the north has released an album that explores this time of violence and change. NPR's Ophébia Quist-Arkton recently met him.
It's Friday night in Bamako, and this club, a live music venue in the Malian capital, has come alive. Guitarist and singer Baba Sala is on the floor. His hometown, Gao, along the banks of the River Niger on the fringes of the Sahara Desert, hit the headlines as the first city in the north to be liberated by French-backed Malian forces in January. Gao was one of three regional northern centres captured by rebels and jihadis a year ago. Islamists warned musicians that their tongues would be sliced out if they continued to sing and play. Sala says artists left in a hurry.
When we saw them burning musical instruments in Gao, we realized the threats against us were dead serious. So all the musicians fled. It is as if a part of our own culture was taken hostage.
They say Mali without music is a country without a soul.
That's so true. I ask myself if Mali can exist without music. Everything important in Mali is linked to music. Where I come from, in the north, in our society, births, baptisms, naming and circumcision ceremonies, marriages, all are accompanied by music.
Baba Sala was in studio putting the finishing touches to his latest album last year when Mali fell apart. He decided to call the new recording Dangé, which means the North in his Sorai language. The album, in part, sounds the alarm about the problems in his northern home region and what Sala describes as human rights violations by the Islamist fighters.
What I'm saying in the album Dangé is, above all, that people must pay attention to what's been happening in the north regarding human rights abuses and punishments. The world must not close its eyes.
The new album features songs about love, but also about social issues such as child labor, the environment, and farming, like this track, Fari, which means agriculture.
Je pense que l'agriculture doit servir de moteur de développement.
You know, agriculture is the ideal engine for development in Africa. We have to develop our continent.
Fari, performed live by Baba Sala and his band, has the patrons swaying and clapping on the dance floor at the club where he plays every Friday night.
Et tout le monde riait, tout le monde dansait. C'est dire que en ce moment,
people laughed, they danced. For the 3 or 4 hours that we were playing, you forgot everything, and everyone became your brother. You see images other than war.
Baba Sala says it warms his heart, and he's hopeful that Mali will come right in the end.
Je pense que la musique a un pouvoir spirituel.
Music has a spiritual power to heal. It has a profound ability to overcome perhaps every hurdle. Maybe people are angry right now and it's difficult to control some of them, but we condemn retaliation against anyone. We are all Malians, we are all brothers. If anyone has anything to say, let them put it on the table and make peace through dialogue.
Baba Sala's new release is called Dangé. Ophébia Quistockton, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Ted Clark.